All right, everybody, welcome to session 267, titled Why USA Christians in 2016 Should Vote Democratic. Before we begin, we ask that the cell phones are turned off and that those attending will be respectful and attentive. It is the mission of Sunstone to host thoughtful and respectful dialogue. Please keep that in mind when engaging in the Q&A portion of this session, following the remarks of the presenter. Those who cannot abide by those guidelines should refrain from commenting and will be asked to leave should they become disruptive. This session is being recorded, and you will be able to purchase it after the presentation ends at the registration desk on the main floor. Take advantage of our symposium special by subscribing to Sunstone Magazine. 7 issues for the price of 6 at the registration desk as well. Consider also purchasing Skull Candy official headphones, customized just for Sunstone. Your support goes directly to keeping symposiums and 40 years of thoughtful dialogue alive and sustainable. Don't forget to check out the bookstore in the ballroom hosted by Benchmark Books. Consider purchasing a book or two to support Mormon studies and scholars. This session is 60 minutes long, and we ask both audience and presenters to keep within the framework of that time so we can allow for the next session to start on time. As a courtesy to other presenters and our attendees, we ask that immediately after this session you clear the room and speak outside so other presentations can begin preparation for the next session. All right. Christians, including Mormons, should consider moral and ethical issues when deciding whom to support in an election. The teachings of Jesus in the four Gospels should be an important guide in considering the issues related to in a campaign. This paper will argue that in the 2016 presidential election, the moral issues lean strongly on the side of the Democrats. William D. Russell is a professor emeritus of American history and politics at Graceland University. He is a longtime presenter at Sunstone and past president of both the Mormon History Association and the John Whitmer Historical Association. All right, I will turn the time over and the microphone over to Mr. Russell.
That means if you want to throw a tomato, you got to step outside. What you got?
Oh, yeah. Good. Yeah, we'll show you when you get out of the theater.
At this, I think I read best from up close without my glasses. No, I think I'll stand further away. And there's one of our most faithful attenders of my session and a great organist. Let me know if I give the mic too far away or you're not hearing it, or just raise your hand or yell something or something, or whatever. At this point in United States history, I do not know how people who claim to be Christian can vote Republican. I assure you that the views expressed here are not simply based on the nomination of Donald Trump, a man whose moral character is rather degenerate, to put it mildly. Rather, for the last 36 years, the Republican Party, with support from a few Democrats, although that's diminished, has turned more and more to favor the rich at the expense of the poor, and to rattle the drums of war without working hard enough to find peaceful solutions. My view is that the central scriptures that should be used in assessing this old question, what would Jesus do, are the four Gospels and the New Testament. I know lots of my LDS friends tell me that the Book of Mormon is read more than the Bible in church services, perhaps because it was Ezra Taft Benson 30 years ago or so, said to read it through once every year. I have read the Book of Mormon about 5 times, and only when I accepted the assignment to teach the Book of Mormon class at Graceland. I was 29 years old and had never read the Book of Mormon when I first taught the course. The other two religion professors had not, and I never read it either. The Community of Christ, today anyway, regards the Bible as our primary scripture, and the Book of Mormon and Doctrine and Covenants are secondary scriptures. We pay no attention to the Book of Abraham, although I enjoyed learning about the planet Kolob. Astronomy has been my favorite science. The future president of our church, Grant McMurray, was in that first Book of Mormon class I taught in 1969. As I asked the students why they signed up for this course, and various ones said, well, for my spiritual growth and so forth, Grant said, well, to be honest, I've never read the Book of Mormon, and this will make me read it. I said, don't be embarrassed, Grant, I haven't read it either. But I was already at about page 200 when the class started, so we had a great time. The professor, and probably most of the 15 students, reading it for the first time, and the discussions were great, and it was one of my favorite, you know, that class itself was one of my favorite all time because of the students in it and the situation of the class. 14 years later, I presented my presidential address to the Mormon History Association in 1983. I included my view that the Book of Mormon is fiction. Grant was sitting at the same table with Lou Midgley. Some of you probably have heard of Lou Midgley. And Grant told me later that Lou was going ballistic during my address. I wasn't surprised because soon Lou sent me a 26-page letter correcting my errors, so I was straightened out. It was funny, after the one of the really favorable responses was this man and his wife, just probably disabled, just tottering along and tottered up to see me, and I think maybe she couldn't speak very well or something. He said, my wife just wanted me to tell you. You said what she's been thinking for a long time, and she's so glad to hear it from somebody. So that was interesting. Lou wrote me several more 26, 27, 28 page letters, and my response would usually be about 2 pages, but that kept him going. For you folks, that LDS, I think to read the Book of Mormon every year through probably means that many of the faithful saints read far more frequently from the Book of Mormon than the Bible. I don't mean to be lecturing my LDS cousins. Well, I guess I do want to advise my LDS cousins and dear friends. The portrait of Jesus is so much different and so much better in the four Gospels than in the Book of Mormon. In 2010, I published a paper in Restoration Studies, one of our occasional journal we put out by the Community of Christ. And in that paper, I compared Joseph's canonical writings, assuming that the Book of Mormon and the others were written by Joseph, they're his writings, and comparing those with the four Gospels. And while I'm confident that Joseph's canonical writings came from his mind and his peepstone, I have no way of knowing whether any portion of them were inspired by some higher authority, like, say, an apostle or 70 or somebody like that. that was kind of mean. Get this close. I've cut this down, so I've got to be sure I'm watching the tape carefully. But you say, how about the promise at the end of the Book of Mormon? My view is that if you read the book all the way to the finish, you probably liked it. So your prayer will bring out something that passes for confirmation. On the other hand, if you didn't make it very far, probably a different outcome. One of my daughters, about 10 or 11 years old at the time, she told me she wanted to read the Book of Mormon. So I gave her my favorite copy, Wilford Wood's reproduction of the 1830 edition. That's what I did for my class, was read it in the original. And historians tend to do that. And she returned it to me two days later, she said she didn't get past page 14. Well, that was the beheading of Laban. Now, Shauna definitely did not feel the Spirit. And would Jesus have ordered Nephi to kill Laban? Of course not. At least not the Jesus of the four Gospels. Two of the absolute worst sentences in Holy Scriptures are very early in the Book of Mormon, about page 14, the story of the beheading of Laban. The Lord slayeth the wicked to bring forth his righteous purposes. Better that one man should perish than a whole nation perish in belief. Can you think of a better rationale for the Inquisition? That puts it pretty well, I think. So let me tell you about an excommunicated member of my church who I think basically agreed with both of those sentences completely. He's an excommunicated member of our church. He's a former tour guide of the Kirtland Temple. And I ended up as an expert witness for his defense when he killed a family of five within his cult. We'll go into later if you want to, about why I served as an expert witness for his defense. There was no problem saying yes. Since Jeff admitted that God made him kill a family of five, our only job was to convince the jury to spare him from the death penalty. I spent a total of 7 hours talking to Jeff at the Lake County Jail in Ohio, and he wrote me a 12-page handwritten letter explaining why he had to kill the Avery family, which included 3 daughters, ages 6 to 15. That's incredible. But anyway, I couldn't make head nor tail of the tales of his 12 pages, other than I knew he was quoting scriptures, largely Book of Mormon, some Old Testament. The only New Testament scriptures I ever read in my 7 hours with him, the letter and so forth, only New Testament text he ever cited was Romans, the wages of sin are death, and Ephesians, wives obey your husbands in everything. So that gave you the clue to his ultimate destiny. Jeff was steeped in the Book of Mormon, and he was especially impressed with several passages which say, repent or be destroyed, or some version of that statement. That will probably be the title of the book manuscript I've written on the case. And one conclusion I came to is that the jury I saw in Painesville, Ohio, would have convicted Nephi of murder and robbery just as easily as they convicted Jeff Lundgren, and he did that very easily. But, you might say, Nephi had an important purpose, to take the Hebrew Scriptures to the New World. But so did Jeff Lundgren, that had an important purpose too. He sought to bring about the return of Jesus Christ and the establishment of Zion, with Kirtland Temple being the center place. And his passion was based on Scripture, mostly the Book of Mormon. Like I say, I spent 40 days visiting inmates in Ohio prisons. Jeff's religious fanaticism ruined the lives of many people, some of whom fortunately are out, and one of them is the director of one of our church reunions. As I study Smith's understanding of Jesus, especially in the Book of Mormon, I saw that his understanding of Jesus is so much different than that of the Gospels. And I believe the four evangelists are far more accurate than Joseph Smith, and a gospel that I find far more Christian. It is clear to me that Smith wrote the Book of Mormon, and therefore the degree to which it was inspired is open to debate, I can't answer that question. But for me, as a historian, the four evangelists present for us a first century understanding of Jesus, while the Book of Mormon, the Doctrine and Covenants, and Joseph's other canonical writings present for us a 19th century portrait of Jesus. In an article in Volume 11 of the Journal of Restoration Studies, I cited four examples of Smith's understanding of Jesus, which just don't fit with the New Testament Jesus. One problem is the nature of Jesus' revelation. In the four Gospels, Jesus' revelation was personal. It was relational. In Jesus, the divine was made known. Jesus taught us to love all people, including those his religious community considered unclean. But in Joseph Smith's scriptures, people are told that they have to keep all the commandments, which must be obeyed if one wants to be saved. And penalties follow failure to obey the commandments. A second problem is that in the Book of Mormon, we read that the United States and certain people are the chosen people, and America is a land of promise, choice above all lands. I first thought about this when I was a student at Graceland, and one of our first converts in Korea came to Graceland, and he said in a class one day that we in Korea really don't find much interest in the Book of Mormon. It's American culture. It doesn't really speak to us. I said, well, maybe he's right. A third major difference between the New Testament Jesus and Joseph Smith's Jesus relates to war and violence. Now, this is kind of off the canonical stuff, but my favorite example from outside the Book of Mormon was Smith saying that after Judas betrayed Jesus, Peter got a rope and hung Judas Iscariot. Seems to me, how could a guy who denied Christ three times be so judgmental? But anyway, that's what Joseph said, according to one of the manuscripts. A fourth difference on the matter is the matter of whether we should always obey the law. In section 58 of the DNC, Joseph wrote that if we obey the laws of God, we have no need to disobey the laws of the land. Now, this was early in his career, 1831. But later in his career, he broke the various laws of the land, including polygamy in Illinois and others. Jesus also did too, if you read the four Gospels, especially Matthew, more clear on that, I think. He was a revolutionary, telling them, yeah, it says so in the law, but do something better than that. One of the favorite hymns in our new hymnal came out 3 years ago, the Hymns of the Saints, is for everyone born, a place at the table. That was especially important, I think especially meaningful to us, because in the last 30 years we had first the big battle over women's ordination, and then more recently the battle over whether or not gays and lesbians should be allowed in the priesthood and allowed to marry. The USA National Conference allowed the latter 3 years ago, and that was a big victory. Okay, now for the political issues. I wanted to explain why I want to focus on the New Testament and not 19th century stuff. One issue is poverty. No, there's 12 issues, and I've dedicated these to memory of the 12 apostles. One is poverty. The Democrats have been far from perfect on the issue of poverty, but they are much more responsive than the Republicans. The Reverend Jim Wallace, editor of Sojourners Magazine, and his team count the number of passages in the Bible which express concern for the poor. I don't remember how many they came up with, but it was well over 1,000. This difference between the two parties on poverty issues has been noticeable for years, and was one reason I switched from Republican to Democrat in the 1960s, after having voted for Nixon. But civil rights and Lyndon Johnson's war on poverty brought me over. The outrageous 2010 Supreme Court decision on Citizens United made the difference far more clear. It was a party-line vote by the justices, 5 Republicans in favor of it, 4 Democratic justices against. Under Citizens United, we are headed for oligarchy rather than a democracy, because now a small number of billionaires can practically buy an election for president or any other office. And the Koch brothers even work on city council races around the country that they find useful and important. Second related issue, anyway, what would Jesus do? Well, he'd be standing with the poor. A related issue is number 2, the minimum wage. Almost everyone knows that the minimum wage desperately needs to be raised. Just imagine yourself with a wife or husband and children trying to live on the minimum wage as it stands now. Bernie Sanders and many other Democrats have advocated raising it to $15. Some large cities have already done that. Most Republicans in Congress are opposed, practically everybody in Republicans are opposed to raising it. But some states controlled by Republicans have wisely said, well, let's raise the minimum wage, and they've done it by a modest dollar or two. At least they did something. That illustrates, in Congress, if Republicans wanted to cooperate on them as compromise with Democrats and their $15, whatever, the two parties could come to some middle ground. I mean, it's a dollar issue. You can come to middle ground very easily. And maybe you could have come up with a $10 or $11 minimum wage. There is clearly a party issue here. Democrats strongly supporting a significant raise, and Republicans resisting for the most part. What would Jesus do? He would be standing with the poor. A third and related issue is tax policy. Like Republicans before him, Trump has promised huge tax cuts which favor primarily the super rich, which allegedly will grow jobs. We've been waiting for that to happen since the first Reagan term. Trump also promised to erase the federal debt right away, but then on the other hand, he wants to cut taxes drastically and do a lot of spending as well, because he's going to just knock out ISIS and everybody else. His challenger, George I, not yet his vice president, called Reagan's plans voodoo economics. Voodoo economics nearly tripled the annual deficit during Reagan's 2 terms. And it continues today as a significant difference between the two parties. Republican Governor Sam Brownback of Kansas and Scott Walker of Wisconsin tried this typical Republican tax policy to an extreme, and has taken both states into a terrible situation where they had to make drastic funds in important services like education and so forth. Brownback is voodoo economics on steroids. Why do Republicans cling tenaciously to this failed policy? Do you suppose that the Republican donor class has anything to do with it? What would Jesus think of our tax policy? Number 4, the fourth issue is the environment and the denial of science. In Iowa, in the 2014 election, we elected a clearly ill-prepared Republican state senator, Joni Ernst, to replace the retiring Tom Harkin, a giant among progressive Democrats. I've known Tom well since before he was first elected to Congress in 1974. 10 years later, he moved to the Senate and spent 30 years there before retiring. I think Jesus would approve of most of what he did. One of his great was the Americans for Disabilities Act, that's Tom's. His brother was, I can't remember which handicap he had, I think he was blind. I think he was deaf. My favorite memory of Tom is one instance when he was running for president in 1992. As perhaps the most progressive Democrat in the field, people in his audience would often yell, "Give him hell, Harkin!" Reminiscent of Harry Truman in 1948. On one occasion, I was watching Tom's speech, and they would yell, "Give them hell, Harkin." And finally, you realize, "I will, and they deserve it." I thought that was Vinnie's Harkin. In three debates between Joni Ernst and our 10-year progressive Democrat congressman named Bruce Braley, Bruce showed himself very knowledgeable on all the major issues, while Ernst showed herself to be in way over her head. But she followed the party script on issues like global warming, saying, as do many Republicans, "Well, I am not a scientist, but," and then showing that she's just going to ignore the conclusions of the vast majority of scientists in the area. Why not say, "I'm not a scientist, but I will be informed by the experts in the field, and therefore I conclude that we must take action, and now." But she had big funding from the Koch brothers, without which she probably would not have even been nominated in a five-way field. I have two granddaughters who were born in 2000 and 2005. If they practice good health habits and are fortunate in not getting caught by a stray bullet from allegedly good guys shooting like a bad guy, will they have safe water to drink, good air to breathe, good soil to grow crops? And as our planet gets hotter and hotter, will there be huge battles over water and immigration as people move from hotter climates to more temperate climates? Incredibly, a significant number of Republicans deny that biology is another issue, but science. An incredible number of Republicans deny that biological evolution is a reality. Recall Republican presidential candidate, short-lived candidate, Scott Walker, going to London to develop some foreign policy cred. And when they asked him if he believed in evolution, he wasn't even willing to say. The British politicians couldn't believe their ears, but he didn't want to offend the Republican base, the fundamentalists particularly. I thought the issue was settled about a century, or at least after a century of debate, after Darwin's Origins of the Species in 1848. But I guess I tend to forget about the influence of the fictitious chapters 1 to 11 of Genesis, which many people think contain literal historical fact. But why is it that Adam and Eve are not mentioned anywhere in the remainder of the Hebrew Bible? They didn't exist in the history of Israel, which starts about 2000 BC with Abraham in Genesis chapter 12. But it's literal history, we're told by some. It's the fourth issue. And it doesn't matter. I think it's one-fifth of it. As the environment gets hotter and hotter, and this issue is immigration, as the environment gets hotter and hotter, people living near the equator will move north or south to more temperate climates, and there will be battles over accepting them into new countries. Many Americans will want a leader with the heavy hand of Donald Trump to keep these newcomers out. But one of the most common themes of the Bible is the importance of welcoming the stranger. Don't Christians stand in opposition to build a wall to keep people out? Don't Christians stand in opposition to those who would ban people of another religion from coming into our country? If Trump wins and builds that wall, both long shots, I hope, how long will it be before a Mexican head of state stands on the other side of that wall and says, "Mr. President," or "Miss President, tear down that wall"? And that's probably what we'll be doing. Sorry. I baptized by sprinkling, so let's just get this out of here. The sixth issue is Muslims. About 3 years ago, I had a student from Azerbaijan who wanted to learn more. I was a retired professor, but she was only here for a semester, and she wanted to learn more about American politics firsthand, so somebody directed her to me. And I gave her an individual study, which involved assigned readings and then writing with me the various Democratic Party activities. I'm not invited to the Republican activities. She is Muslim and appeared to be a faithful Muslim. When we first went to a political event, I pulled up at the women's dorm. She was my only passenger, but she climbed in the back seat. I invited her to sit in front. She said, "Oh no, it would be against my culture." We had great times traveling to these events. She would often be leaning against the front seat, you know, to get closer to talk about issues and so forth. Nargis was a delight to work with. During that same semester, on another occasion, I went to the Iowa State House to talk with my three former students who are elected members of the Iowa House of Representatives. Mark Smith, a Democratic leader, took me back to the area where the Democratic leaders have their office so we could talk. Soon, a representative from inner city Des Moines came in, Akko Abdul, and I'm sorry I didn't look up his last name. He's the only Muslim in the legislature. He was carrying his prayer rug. It was 3 p.m. and time to pray. Talking with him, and from what I've known about him from others and the Des Moines Register, he's a terrific youth leader in inner city Des Moines. Having met him and everything, I think he's a lovely human being. I think it was about a day after that that I received one of those hate emails being sent around asking you to forward this to your 20 of your friends and so forth. It condemned Muslims universally. It was passed to me by one of the real saints and workhorses in our Lamoni congregation. No one would think that she would ever pass along a hate speech sheet like this. I wrote back to her and told her about the stark contrast between this hate speech at the same time I was teaching RDs and getting better acquainted with ACO. Even good people can become bigots on an issue if they fed the wrong information. One of the best things George W. Bush, or George II, did right after 9/11 was gather some of the leading Muslim clerics together, and President Bush declared to the world that our issue is not with their religion. Islam is peace, he said. I've seen reruns of that recently. We would strongly oppose the attempts of the Ku Klux Klan to portray themselves as typical Christians. But over the last century and a half, they have practiced what we might call radical Christian terrorism. But of course, we don't call it that. We had a student come to Grayson who was a member of the Ku Klux Klan. He was a freshman, and he had been groomed by his father, I believe, to be the next Grand Wizard of Iowa, or whatever they call it, chief guy in Iowa. But he was basically a nice guy, and he took especially classes from Bill Yonke, our Mennonite historian from Kansas, who's taught American history and so forth. And based on his research in Yonke's classes and what Yonke said, he finally concluded, maybe the Ku Klux Klan isn't a Christian organization like my mother or my father, whoever, my father probably told me. So he said, I think I'll resign from the Ku Klux Klan. But he didn't want to resign to his father. He'll give his robe back to his father or whoever, his mentor. So he walked into Yonke's office one day and he had a box. He said, I just feel like I want to resign from the Ku Klux Klan, and I want to resign to you. Can I just give you my robe? Bill came across the hall, came to my room, closed the door, locked it, the eyes bugging out of his head, and he told me what was happening. So he took me across the hall and he reached down into his bottom drawer, pulled out that Klan and lifted it up. It just about chills. But Bill finally decided, I'm not the guy to resign from. You know, just go burn it or something. But anyway, Ken became a really nice guy. I mean, he always was a nice guy, but he became a very understanding person about prejudice and so forth because of Bill Yonke mainly. Remember how Donald Trump called for a temporary Muslim ban in the U.S. if he becomes president? This would be unheard of and unconstitutional. A seventh issue is civil rights. Historically, the major issue regarding civil rights has been related to African Americans, most of them slaves, until 1865. But at the end of the 19th century, a rigid system of racial segregation developed in the South. It was the Republican Party which led the way out of this racist inferno. The Republican Party founded a party opposed to slavery. They were the good guys back then. But as many Southern Democrats saw it, slavery was something that had to be bitterly opposed, and we know what happened after that. But in the 20th century, because of leadership by Franklin Roosevelt, Harry Truman, John Kennedy, and especially Lyndon Johnson, they managed to bring the vast majority of blacks from the Republican Party to the Democratic Party. And so meanwhile, there's been a steady shift of the Republicans, the Democrats in the South, who tend to be racist, steady shift of them to the Republican Party, as Lyndon Johnson predicted. Since that time, new civil rights issues have arisen. Women's rights, the right for women to control their own body, decision as to whether to bear children, the rights of those with disabilities, and the rights of GLBT, that community. Each of these issues has found the Democrats taking the lead for justice with regard to these marginalized group of people. Number 8, women. On women's reproductive freedom, the difference between the two parties is very clear. After Roe versus Wade in January 73, it was mainly Republicans in Congress and in state legislatures who adopt various measures to limit the reach of abortion rights, like banning federal and state money for abortions and so forth, thereby leaving poor people without the ability to exercise their constitutional right, and sometimes going through what we've often called a dangerous back alley abortion. Many young women are conned into sex with older men who sometimes promise marriage in order to get her in bed. I had a friend in church when I was about ninth grade. She was like 13 or 14. She was tricked by a 22-year-old divorcee. He proposed marriage, but then Carol got pregnant, and he reneged on his promise. So my dad, who was the Carol's pastor, met with this gentleman, I mean rapist, and went through the things that he would have to pay over the next 19 years. Now, he wasn't listening very carefully until my dad finally said, "And if I don't have a check in my hands before we leave this meeting, we're going to charge you with statutory rape." Oh, that got his attention. Dad got that check that afternoon. My wife, Lois, taught in a nearly all-black junior high in St. Louis for some time. Dee Dee was a very good student and had aspirations to go to college and prepare for a good career. Some guy who was handsome and smooth talker got her pregnant. Her parents, mother and grandmother, wouldn't help her. So she talked to her teacher, Lois, who got her in touch with the help she needed, and then Lois helped her financially with the cost of the abortion. At our wedding in St. Louis a few years later, Dee Dee, who I don't think Lois had seen for years, showed up, surprised us, didn't know if she knew about it, and then with a very nice gift and appreciation for Lois. It was wonderful to see her doing well and seeking to fulfill her dreams. I believe Lois did what Jesus would have done in that situation. I don't care what certain politicians say. Number 9 is gay rights. These 6 or 7 one-sentence statements in the Bible about men having sex with a man, you know, terrible it is, should be put to death and so forth, have absolutely no relevance for the issues we have been discussing in our society today in recent years. The issues today are about whether two people of the same sex can be married, can become ministers, and have their relationships approved by their peers, their church, and their government. And so these issues were unheard of in biblical times. So they really, those biblical passages are completely irrelevant. In our USA National Conference call to consider whether priesthood or marriage and GOPT people should be accepted by our church, both passed with votes in the range of 75% to 80%, which was a delightful result for some, many of us anyway. Based on the four Gospels, is it not hard to conclude that Jesus would have supported these decisions and that he would love GLBT people just as easily as loved others? Number 10, labor unions. My uncle, Tom Williams, was a Welsh coal miner, as all my mother's family were, in southern Iowa. And he was in the mines for about 20 years, from 1900 to about 1920, beginning at age 12. But later he left the mines, spent a year at Grayson preparing himself to become a full-time salaried minister in the church. He became state president in Lamoni when he was laid off by the Depression in 1932. So he became a Lamoni businessman, owning at one time or another a local coffee shop, a bowling alley, and finally a pool hall. Some of my friends, like Paul Edwards, really liked Tom, because when they were playing pool and smoking a cigarette, Tom would look out the window and see the dean come, and he'd say, "Hey, come to the dean," and say, "You did ditch their cigarette." So Tom did them great service. But anyway, one time, Tom and I, while I was at Grayson, I drove him to Sheraton, one of the mining towns, Tom and his wife, Lida, and walking down the street, and he encounters a former friend from the mines. And the friend says, "Well, Tom, how long were you in the mines?" And Tom said, "20 years. "Oh, Tom, you were just a kid in the mines." "Well, how long were you in the mines?" 53 years, probably 12 to 65. It's amazing this guy was still alive several years after he left the mines and retired from the mines. Anyway, Tom is a big supporter of the United Mine Workers. In fact, he was a personal friend of John L. Lewis. A friend of mine from Grayson has a museum to John L. in Lucas, Iowa, near Sheraton. Eventually United Mine Workers got legal recognition, likely not until the Wagner Act of 1935 under Roosevelt, which ensured the right for unions to organize and negotiate with management for wages, hours, and working conditions. when you walked into Tom and Lyda's house in the morning, right away, and it was really the dining room that you met, and there was a huge portrait of Franklin Roosevelt staring in the face when you came in the room. But anyway, the legal recognition of unions under Roosevelt and the GI Bill under Truman were major factors in the creation of the middle class in America, especially after World War II. Congregation I went to, nobody was in college before World War II, and after college, quite a few of us ended up going to college. Now many Republicans, along with businesses and interests, are trying to destroy labor unions, and they've done a good job so far. And especially in Republican-controlled states like Wisconsin. Thank you, Scott Walker, your millions from the Koch brothers were sure helpful. In my view, we need strong labor unions to compete with big government and big business. Big business is trying to reduce that. Number 11 is, I've got to quit it soon, is capital punishment. In my senior year in high school, I wrote an essay on capital punishment in my senior English class. My thesis was, kill them, they deserve it, and it will save money. I hope Miss Rhodes didn't know that my father was a full-time salaried minister in the RLDS Church. She wrote some strong marginal notes, which made me rethink the whole matter. And 6 years later, when I was on the editorial staff of our official church publication, the Saints Herald, I wrote an editorial entitled, Israel Could Have Listened to Buber. Martin Buber, the great English philosopher theologian, had urged his government not to execute Adolf Eichmann as an act of mercy, one of the great Holocaust villains. Among the reasons I gave were, one, the death penalty is often imposed in a discriminatory manner because of race, poverty, lack of education, and those unable to obtain proper defense. Two, a wrongfully imposed, this may be the most important one, a wrongfully imposed execution cannot be corrected. And three, there are other alternatives to death. And four, death cuts off any opportunity for redemptive work. Five, there's no conclusive evidence that capital punishment deters. And six, capital punishment tends to brutalize the human spirit and leaves its mark on those who participate in the judgment and execution and on society as a whole. In a later issue, a retired managing editor of the Herald, Chris Hartson, wrote an editorial correcting my errors. So it's good for the old timers to correct the young Turks. Chris was a Goldwater Republican. Unfortunately, public opinion in the U.S. was becoming more and more in favor of the death penalty as we move through the more conservative years in the Reagan era and so and beyond. As the 2000 World Conference of the Unity of Christ approached, retired Apostle Roy Shaver and I worked on a resolution against the death penalty. I introduced it in the Monte Conference to pass by a large margin, and went to World Conference, and we passed it by a two-thirds margin. I was shocked and delighted. Knowing the general opinion of the American public at the time, so I thought, maybe our church is well ahead of public opinion. On a couple of occasions, I traveled to Kansas City to meet Roy Shaver to demonstrate on a much-traveled corner of Kansas City on the day of the scheduled execution. Missouri is really big on state-sponsored killing. A lot of cars honked at us coming by, some giving us the uplifted finger, and others lifting a different finger. Number four is gun violence. About the most unbelievable thing about gun violence is how the NRA and other gun rights interest groups have been able to control the Republican Party and make their politicians buy an absolute lie that claims that the Second Amendment gives an absolute right to own any kind of gun, and any attempt to regulate guns in any way violates this allegedly sacred constitutional right. One of my major fields really constitutional law, and that is BS. Anyway, perhaps the low point in our U.S. history on this matter is the failure of Congress to pass any gun control measure, even after the slaughter of 20 precious. You know the story. The leading spokesman for the NRA, a man whose name is not to be uttered in polite company, said that we need to put our attention on medical health. But that was a phony reason, because the NRA opposed closing the background check loophole, where we might be able to deny guns to persons who have documented mental problems. And surveys have shown that a majority of NRA members themselves favor some of the reasonable gun controls by a very high number in some cases. So don't blame the members of the NRA, it's the leaders. Political science research has often concluded that the elite leaders of interest groups don't really reflect the majority thinking of their leaders, and that would be the NRA today. It is clear that the only principle that counts for the NRA is that anything that threatens to reduce the number of guns sold or ammunition sold, that's all to always to be opposed, no matter how absurd their position might seem to reasonable people, and how deadly the outcome might be. I regard the NRA as bordering on a criminal organization because of the violence that their measures have inflicted upon people. Imagine what it feels like to be the parents of one of those six-year-old kids, or the parent of one of the kids who survived but saw so many of his friends slaughtered in his classroom. Why is it that our rate of murder by guns is so much higher than the other advanced democracies in the world? Could it be that they have reasonable gun regulations, which they do? Can you imagine Jesus not denouncing those responsible for the lack of reasonable gun legislation? The issues of Christian ethics and morals have leaned toward the Democrats for years now, but this year, with a really dangerous Republican nominee, our situation is critical. And every vote for a third party rather than Hillary, it helps Donald Trump become the next president of the United States. Our situation is critical. And so I urge you, no matter even if you believe all the crap about Hillary that's been said for the last 25 years, we need her as the president. She's very well prepared. Remember on that Ralph Nader, not only in New Hampshire, not only in Florida, but also in New Hampshire alone, either of those two states, he cost Gore the presidency. So, think very carefully about that. So what would Jesus do? If he's one of our citizens, he'd be voting Democrat for both houses of Congress. So in conclusion, I am Bill Russell, and I approve this message.
So how do you want to work the Q&A here?
I can just walk around through the audience.
It's totally up to you. I can walk the mic around for you.
Okay, go ahead.
If you want. And then if you want, you can even, I know this mic doesn't work quite as well.
Hello?
Is that working?
Okay.
I'm thinking back on the 1972 election when Richard Nixon took every state in the country except Massachusetts and the District of Columbia. Yeah. Frankly, have a feeling at this point in time that Hillary Clinton is going to take every state in the country, possibly with the exception of Wyoming and Utah. Comment.
Well, I this is kind of depressing. Maybe I should walk through the audience. I don't know, but I do tend to feel that after a very good convention this week with some great speeches. I just mentioned the three, Michelle and Barack and Hillary, but many other well-managed convention too. They handled very well the Bernie. I voted for Bernie in the Iowa caucuses, but handled. I think you're going to get the Bernie negative people down to about 5%. And I think as the campaign goes on, you know, Trump seems to think he can just keep on campaigning the way he did in the primary. You don't do that in American politics. In the primary, he was appealing to about the 30% segment of the American people. In the general election, you know, the whole country and all segments are potentially voting. So no, I think Hillary's going to win. I think Trump's going to go down. And I know people say that's what we thought for last year, but it's a whole different situation now. And his speech at the convention was just everything's terrible. You know, our military is terrible. It's a disaster. Is just everywhere. No, I think Hillary will win, but not by Nixon proportion. I could carry it around if you want.
It's totally up to you.
Yeah, I'll do that because I think there might be some people I need to slap in the head or anything like that. Right? I see some out there like that. Yeah. Yes.
I listened to your presentation 2 years ago, and you were talking about I always want to call them RLDS, but the Community Christ, that they had an analogous problem to the Utah Church in that there was a tendency to think the civil rights movement was run by the commies and stuff like that, that you had at least a little bit of the same problem along those lines. Ezdrudev Pence, of course, was stronger about it.
Yeah, but, yeah.
I guess what I'm wondering is, it just looks to me like on the women front and on the LGBT front and others, the communal crisis has become so progressive, and I'm just wondering, how do you explain that much change?
Well, I think the idea that we had quite a few of these anti-McCarthy-type guys in our church is very overstated. We had a few, and if I might have said that W. Wallace Smith, the first of the Wallace Smith presidents.
That was one you mentioned.
I'd probably call him a racist. And he was, in my opinion. He wrote an editorial in St. Cyril in 1962 that I thought was just horrible. And I wondered, what's he been reading? He's got to be reading that kind of stuff, although he wasn't that bad, you know. He said things like, well, you know, in some districts, black schools are even, talking about segregation, black schools are even more well-funded than the white schools. Well, give me an example. So anyway, yeah, there was some of it, but we did have, both Israel A. and W. Wallace were not good on race. I think far from what you're talking about.
What is your opinion as to why the polls are so close between Clinton and Trump? Is the old political dictum true, the masses are asses?
I'm not going to comment on your last statement, but there's a lot of anger in the country, and Trump has plugged into that really well. But I think, you know, there's the time, as election goes on, we've already had one of the four biggest events, you know, the conventions, and the other three are the debates between the two candidates. And Hillary's a good debater, and she's a better debater than she is a public speaker. But last night she was terrific as in the public speaking department. But no, and people like Barack and Michelle, Michelle's speech was fantastic. And she came to Grayson, and I invited her, and 300 people, this is a year before you elected, and 300 people there, and she was wonderful. Just wonderful. But anyway.
All these people, I mean, who's voting for him? I mean, Muslims won't, women.
That's why I think the numbers are against him. But those people don't vote in Republican primaries. They vote in the general election and then Democratic primaries. So no, I think he's in great trouble. I sure hope so. Well, should I give the mic to Glenn Leonard? All in favor?
Okay. Yeah. I just want to speak with some caution because I heard the gentleman in the front say, you know, she's going to win. If you care about this election, you've got to work. The most recent polls, Trump is ahead in every one of those polls, including the swing states of Pennsylvania, Ohio, and Florida. This, we can all sit because most of us, I've said many times, you know, he's finished. You know, there is a lot of anger, and there's obviously a large part of the population that I may not understand that he appeals to. But I think people are really going to have to work hard. This is no given election. And hopefully she'll get a bump out of this election. But as bad as the Republican convention was, she was about 5 percentage points ahead. She's now 3 to 7%. It actually gets worse when they throw in Stein and Johnson. And of course you have the release of the FBI report. And you have the WikiLeaks. WikiLeaks have already announced they're going to release a whole nother series. So this is not a given. And most of my Democrats, there's no way. This election has finally really scared me. And so if it matters, I think you're going to have to work. It is not a given, and it may be hard to understand. The polling, but the polling is right now going Trump's way. And I think we should wake up. It was a good convention, but it's not a given. So I hate to put a damp on it's an easy election. Mm-hmm. And I still favor her, but only slightly.
Trump?
Well, I mean, I, no, the prediction, I think I would only... I think it's going to be a hard election to win. And it shocks me to say that. So it's another.
I think the prophet Glenn is pretty accurate there. You really need to work very hard. Yeah. And earlier I thought, see, he was a false prophet earlier when he was predicting Trump's going down. Now he's a true prophet.
I can meet you halfway. You know, that's here in Utah, being such a rabid Republican state, I'm not sure that Hillary has really much of a chance. And I say this as a Democratic legislative chair. On the other hand, if we really want to see change, we can't just stop at the presidency.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because we have to do everything in the down elections to change the composition of the Congress and to change things on a local level. Bill, you presented a nice rationale for doing things differently. How would you recommend we get that out?
Anybody wants an email copy can sign in and send it to all your friends. I write a column, regular column for the best, most renowned newspaper in Southwest Iowa, Southwest Decatur County, Iowa, the Omaha Chronicle. But I do send it to about 250 people, including some people in this room. So I'd be happy to put you on my email list to get my column. But anyway, I do. I'm active in the party, and I write a lot, and so I'm doing what I can. So I recommend that you. 5 more minutes to go. Okay.
Nine.
I've got.
Yeah, 9.
7.
Yeah. I was holding up 9. So.
Oh, okay. That's what was supposed to count. 3 of those fingers. Yeah.
I can get you part way.
Good. Yeah, that's a good idea. Just get up to the
hall. I'm Carl Braithwaite. I'm a political scientist as well. And the thing you haven't mentioned that makes it so that the election will likely be really difficult, these are the two most disliked presidential candidates we've had in modern times. And when that happens, the negatives can keep people from. Yeah. I know so many people who say, I won't vote for Trump, but I will not vote for Hillary either. And they're going to throw their vote away for one of the independents. So, Nate Silver runs these simulations of elections. Mm-hmm. His last one still has her 60% more probable to win, but that's dropped 12% in the last 2 weeks.
Well, actually, his most recent one has Trump.
Oh, does it? Okay, I haven't read for a few days.
Silver?
Yes.
And he's good.
He now predicts.
Oh, yeah, he is.
He's very good.
Last year, you know, not only predict Obama right, but every single state, except all but one Senate race in North Dakota, he got right.
What's he now predicting about this one?
He is now
Trump.
Predicting.
He's predicting a slight edge to Trump right now.
Slight edge to Trump.
Silver.
Who is
Nate Silver. He's the New York Times, isn't he?
He used to be. He runs his own. It's called 538.
Oh, yeah, 538, yeah.
Now, he did clarify in his latest poll that if that were the election today, that was before the Democratic Convention, that it had slipped that much, that the movement to Trump was that great.
Yeah. See, historically, there's always, virtually always a bump from the convention. And I think we'll get as good a bump or better than Trump got from his convention because it was so well done, but it remains to be seen. The polls that come out in the next week, midweek or after, will probably be a good test of where we stand after the two conventions.
And the debates will be important.
And then the three debates. And the vice presidential debate, you know, Pence is so far to the right. I have relatives in Indiana. He's about as conservative as you can possibly come. So, that's why I feel optimistic, but I think probably the prediction here is a little overly. And then as a Democratic Party member and activist, I've been chairman of the party for 12 years in the past, we always try to tell people in an election that we think we're going to win, don't take it for granted. You know, we got to get it out. The Republican, or the conservative columnist, George Will, hopes that Trump loses all 50 states. He just can't stand the guy. Okay, other comments? Questions? So if there's anybody who wants to speak up for Trump, show your courage. this is the ideal time. Yes, Toby. We want you to tell us why you believe. why you're staying, whatever.
A comment here. I found it incredible that there's such hostility and animosity toward Hillary.
Yeah.
It just doesn't make any sense.
That's right.
These are people who are my sister, intelligence, yeah. So I can't stand that woman.
Yeah. Why not?
Well, I think
there's a lot. Well, that's because the polls are where they are. Mm-hmm. There's just a lot of people who feel that way about Hillary, which is unfortunate.
Yeah, and the way I look at it is, there's a large portion of the Republican Party, especially, has not accepted either Clinton or Hillary, or Obama, as legitimate president. So their legitimacy is discredited, and so they've done everything you can for Hillary for 25 years to run it down. I think she's a good enough communicator to cut into that quite a bit. I think the convention this week was really dedicated to that. Although I missed some of it, just some meeting going on in Salt Lake City, but anyway, I'm optimistic, but you got to work really hard. I was for Bernie, but if Bernie had been nominated, we'd hear all kinds of things about socialism, and he'd be not a socialist of Norway and so forth. He'd be a socialist of communist Russia, China, Cuba, and so forth.
This question about the animosity towards Hillary.
Yeah.
We don't listen to Fox News. We don't listen to talk radio.
Yeah.
There's a whole different world out there that activates the mind of people, and that's the reason.
Yeah, yeah. I've seen four surveys in the last 10 years or so that show those who watch primarily Fox News are the least informed and most ignorant of politics. Those who watch public radio and television are the most well-informed, and the others in between.
Stephen Colbert has said that if Trump is our next president, he will probably also be our last president. With his thin skin and control of the nuclear arsenal, what are your comments about that?
Mm-hmm. Well, that's why I'm referring to my granddaughters. You know, I mean, I mentioned stray bullets from a gunfire. But what kind of world are we going to have in 4 years if he's the president? He has such a thin skin, quick temper. Replies and assaults people and insults people who he's already defeated in the primaries and he continues to insult them. That's stupid.
But people like it. Some people like it.
One of my most intelligent and dearest friends is so concerned about the Supreme Court nomination that I just know he's going to vote for Trump. He gives what he considers to be a rational reason for voting for Trump. I think the Fox News watchers hate Hillary because they want to hate Hillary after listening to all the stuff about Hillary. Yeah. There is very little rationality to me in hatred for Hillary Clinton. Unless you're just such a rabid right-wing Republican, the fellow I'm talking about is a very reasonable, moderate Republican, but he's concerned about the Supreme Court, and I can't imagine that outweighing whatever Trump might do to
him. Yeah, she's made her mistakes, but nothing compared to Trump's mistakes in his life, In the 1912 election, there was this Republican guy, I can't remember exactly what the context was, he said, I just can't stand Mitt Romney, but I know if Obama's elected, they've got a four-year plan to come in and confiscate all of our guns during his second term. anyway, any more? We'll probably have time for one last. Maybe.
One more question.
One last question.
The dislike of Hillary, one of the huge problems, she has a 20%, and we've been long-term Hillary supporters, but right now she's sitting, people believe Trump at 20% better than they believe Hillary. There's something like 76% of the general population don't trust him. I just think,
it's a cautionary. We're going to really have to work, because I think this is a really important election and with a lot at stake. And frankly, every Democrat might say, oh, this is going to be a breeze. And it's not.
Well, I trust Trump, too, to really screw up.
Let's pray. All right, everybody. William D. Russell, thank you all for your comments and questions.
Thank you for coming.